KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
And Breezy, the high in the low 40s.
I write stories, and my hope is that whoever likes the kind of stories that I like will connect to my stories.
When I first got to Uganda, there was one cancer specialist for a country of 34 million people. And from a research perspective, that's limiting because there's only so much research you can do with one collaborator.
You know, I thought it was funny when I gave Henrietta to you as a gift, then I come over to visit her, and the only pictures she's taken so far are pictures of her butt on the copy machine. Quite frankly, I thought that was a little rude. She's an innocent cloud cow, after all. She doesn't need to be taught those things.
Katie Sewell will bring us the story of a personified cow later this hour. Good morning. I'm Marcy Silman. This is KUOW. Steve Scherer will be back on Monday. Also coming up this hour, writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie on how being a Nigerian has impacted the kinds of stories she tells. We'll have a weekend forecast from Nick Bond. But first, we're going to talk about health. For the past couple of weeks, if you're a listener to the station, you've heard a series of reports about cancer in third world countries. They're the work of Joanne Silberner. You know her health reporting from her tenure with NPR. She's now an artist in residence at the University of Washington Department of Communications and a reporter traveling around the world. A little bit different, Joanne, than your job covering health policy specifically.
Sure was.
Thanks for being here. This is a story that I guess I hadn't thought much about cancer in the third world. When we consider developing nations, we hear about water-related diseases, things like dysentery and cholera, obesity, non-obesity. Why did you want to pursue this?
Well, because I was thinking the same way you were, that cancer, people don't live long enough to get it. You couldn't treat it anyway. There weren't many cases. Why bother? Then I heard about a seminar that was being given down at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. It's a full-day seminar on cancer, and I thought, this is really ridiculous. It's like a fad. We have to go and, you know, find a new thing to do in developing countries. So I went to the seminar, and I found out how incredibly wrong I was. Cancer is common in developing countries. They do get it there. Some cancers are very treatable. The cancers that you can treat with chemotherapy or simple surgery can be treated. Some of the cancers can be easily detected and dealt with early on, and it's not happening.
Is that a financial decision, or is it an attitude decision on the parts of those governments?
It's both. It's financial from the NGO point of view. You know, it's much easier to go in and say, we're going to, you know, deliver a vaccine. We're going to put up a treatment center. We're going for HIV. We're going to do this. We're going to go after a single disease. Cancer is a slew of diseases. So NGOs just haven't been that interested. They haven't seen the numbers or haven't paid attention to the numbers. And then the attitudinal part of it that you just mentioned, within the countries themselves, people don't really see cancer. First of all, they don't see it as a single disease. A lot of people don't on the ground just don't know what it is. In fact, in Uganda, my translator kept using the word swellings. And I finally said to her, why are you saying swellings? Why don't you just say cancer when you're translating? And she said, because that's not what the words mean. They don't have a word for cancer.
They don't even have a word for it.
In some of the tribal languages in Uganda, they don't have a word. So they don't have a real concept of it. Sometimes they think, well, it's bad luck, or I bumped my head, that's why I have a lump, or my neighbor wished a hex on me, and that's why that's happening, or they confuse it with another disease. It's just not really seen in a lot of places. You know, there are other places like India, which is both a rich and a poor country, where they do have a sense of it. But in Uganda and Haiti, not much of a sense of it.
How did you choose where you were going to do your research?
Well, you can pretty much go anywhere, and you'll find a different story every place you
go.
You know, Uganda's story is this is a country that's struggling to come out of, you know, some very bad years many years ago. The Uganda Cancer Institute there was a very respected research institute until Idi Amin came along. The doctors left. There are bones to build back up on.
I see.
In Uganda, and I thought that was interesting. India, rich and poor. So they've developed some of the very things that are being introduced in developing countries. They were primary, along with Johns Hopkins University, in developing this new vinegar test for cancer. Haiti, I went to because Partners in Health is there. And what they've decided to do something that can be replicated, and I don't know if it will be. They have a primary care clinic with no oncologist, but they're doing cancer care because they call up every week to Boston to the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, which is a bit like the Hutch, and they get advice.
We're talking with Joanne Silberner, whose stories about cancer in the third world have been running on KUOW for the past couple of weeks, and it got me to taking a step back and thinking, in my lifetime, cancer in this country has evolved from, you know, the disease who you dare not say its name, sort of like Voldemort, to something that we hear about. There's been a lot of public education about, diagnosis, even prevention, diet, things like that. How is cancer viewed? I mean, aside from tribes that don't even know what it is, how is it viewed in the third world? Is it still a stigmatized disease?
It's absolutely stigmatized. You don't admit it. You don't tell anyone. People think it's infectious. They think it's your own fault. So it is. There was a woman in Haiti who said to me, you know, I didn't want to tell my neighbors. And then when her neighbors found out, the other stigma is on treatment. They say treatment doesn't work, so don't go in. She went in for surgery, and all her neighbors said, you're crazy. You're just going to die. Now, there's a reason for them to say that, because so many cancers are diagnosed late, because people don't go in early, that people do die even if they get treatment. And that's sort of the self-feeding prophecy and an effect of stigma.
In the countries that you visited, where do you feel like there's the most hope that at least basic cancers will be diagnosed and basic treatment will be delivered?
Actually, all three had points of hope. In Haiti, Partners in Health is trying to prove that you can do this on a primary care basis. They're trying to set up a model. And Partners in Health is a remarkable group, and they've really changed the way healthcare is delivered. And this whole primary care approach that anyone who walks in the door, we can help. They had been sending people back to Boston on occasion, which is a not very efficient way to care for people with cancer. But now they're trying to show that this can work. In Uganda, there's this collaboration between the Uganda Cancer Institute and the Hutch here, which is really making a difference. They're training oncologists. There used to be only one oncologist in all of Uganda from 2004 to 2008.
Oh, my gosh.
And he says, I was very busy. He's a very modest man. But the Hutch has helped him. They've gotten together. They've trained 9 or 10 oncologists. So he can now focus on trying to raise money and trying to get things going to get more going there. India, again, a very sophisticated country in a lot of ways. And they're pioneering inexpensive approaches to cancer.
So you have covered healthcare policy and healthcare for many, many years. Was there anything that you learned in reporting these stories that really stopped you in your tracks?
Oh, boy. When you say that, the faces come back to me of the kids that I met. And they're tough. That's tough. Some of these doctors and other folks who work out there, I don't know how they do this on a day-to-day basis. It's just heartbreaking. I learned that there is hope. The first thing I learned was things are really bad. And then the second thing I learned was, there is hope. There are things happening. There are things going on. And, if people pay a little more attention, as they have with HIV. When you look, that was the comparison I heard. I talked to Steve Gloyd, who's at the University of Washington, before I went on this trip. And I was saying to him, can cancer really, is it really worth diagnosing and treating? And he said, that's exactly what they said about HIV. And now look at how many millions of people have been saved.
Joanne Silberner's former health policy reporter at NPR. We're lucky to have her in Seattle. She's an artist in residence at the University of Washington Department of Communications. And her series on cancer in these three third world countries has been running for the past couple of weeks. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
Clouds and rain, 43 degrees right now in the University District. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of this morning, tapering off to just a chance of rain later today, the high in the low 40s. It's going to be cloudy tonight, no rain expected, the low in the upper 30s. Cloudy, rainy, and breezy again tomorrow, the high in the low 40s.
Support for KUOW comes from Chocolate Box, now focusing solely on Northwest chocolatiers and winemakers for last-minute holiday and hostess gifts for chocolate and wine lovers of all ages. Gift ideas and details are at sschocolatebox.com.
It's 9:15. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information.
I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher. So here's a little story. A parasite worms its way into a host body, hijacks the host's nervous system, then begins to control the host's behavior. Sounds like the plot of a thrilling TV show. In fact, a zombie show. But really, it's the subject of study in the latest issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology. Who knew? Scientists have long known that parasites can take over and manipulate invertebrate and even some vertebrate hosts. Recent studies have begun to explain how they do it, complicating our understanding of parasites and our brains. And the person who was the guest editor of the Journal of Experimental Biology and who does a lot of this research is Dr. Shelley Adamo, who's an insect behavioral physiologist at Dalhousie University, a professor in the university's Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. Dr. Adamo, am I saying your name right?
Yes, well, I'll answer to anything that's close, and but we usually say Adamo.
Okay. Well, thank you for being with us. Zombie parasites. What are we talking about actually when we talk about these parasites?
Well, there are a whole class of parasites, and they're not related to each other. So these parasites are from various groups of animals. So they're not all from the same phylogenetic group, and some of them aren't even animals. You can have viruses that will also do the same thing. But what they all have in common is they are all able to enter into the body of the host, and using a variety of different methods, are able to, in a sense, hijack the brain. They're able to manipulate the way the host's brain works, and they change the behavior of the host in such a way that it promotes their transmission. So, of course, one of the classic cases with a virus with rabies is you have, say, a dog that becomes rabid will have heightened aggression, lots of salivation, and it will have a tendency to bite. And that's exactly what the virus needs to get to its next host. And so that's something that many people are familiar with, that particular story. But there's a whole range of different types of parasites that do similar types of things. They don't make people run around and bite each other, but they do cause animals and potentially people who get infected with a variety of different pathogens to also have a change in their behavior in a way that benefits the host.
And so the virus or the organism, the parasite, gets out of it propagating itself? Is that?
Yes. Yes, that is correct. So that's sort of how we define it, is that many parasites and pathogens cause different changes in behavior, but we're looking at the ones that are doing it and appears to increase the ability of the parasite to reproduce, to get to another host primarily.
Is this something new, or have scientists been studying these parasites for a while?
It's been known for a very long time, so it's probably been recognized for hundreds of years that parasitized animals can have a change in their behavior, but it's been studied probably over the last 100 years, sort of just the phenomena of it. But what's exciting is that very recently we've started to get a good handle on the mechanisms, how the parasites are actually making these changes. And that work was stymied for a long time. It's technically difficult work to do. But one of the reasons we had this special issue is there's been a lot of new information coming out, say, the last 5 years or so. And so we wanted to try to get that out and let people know where the field has managed to carry forward to.
Well, you are a neuroparasitologist, correct? Is that?
I guess it's such a new field, it really doesn't have a name. One of the editors at Journal of Experimental Biology, regular editors, sort of coined that phrase. So maybe it's a field now, but really I'm a behavioral physiologist. I'm interested in how physiology influences behavior, and eventually got very interested in how parasites are able to change physiology to manipulate the behavior of their host.
Well, so do you actually study an insect's brain?
I mean, yes. So I have the system that I work on is an insect system, and some of the most dramatic changes in behavior occur in insect hosts. It may be that maybe because their brains are smaller, easier to manipulate. And the system that I work on is a caterpillar that gets hit with a parasitic wasp. And the parasitic wasp lays her eggs inside the caterpillar, And the wasps hatch out, the little baby wasps, the wasp larvae hatch out, and they actually just drink the blood of the caterpillar for the first little bit of their development. They don't do anything to the caterpillar's behavior. It's quite normal. But then they come to the point where they have to get to the outside of the caterpillar. And what they do is basically drill a hole through the body wall of the caterpillar, spin a little cocoon once they're on the outside, and then it takes them about 4 or 5 days to pupate. And it's during that 4 or 5 days that you have this incredible switch in the caterpillar's behavior. Caterpillars are really just little eating machines. That's what they do for a living. They eat. And what happens with these caterpillars is they stop eating, and they stop having much in the way of spontaneous movement. But the interesting thing to me, or to people who study these sorts of systems, is that the animal isn't, it's not like it's sickly or it's on its last legs. It can actually last another 2 weeks. It eventually starves to death. But the animal has very robust reflexes, and what it ends up becoming is a bodyguard for the little wasps.
Wow.
That are turning, the larvae that are turning into adult wasps. And so what it does is it sits on the leaf. It doesn't eat anymore, doesn't move around much, but if anything comes close to it, it whips around and it does a defensive maneuver, and it protects those wasp pupae from any other predator that might be around that the caterpillar can defend it from.
Wow.
So the caterpillar now has changed. It's not eating anymore. It's not doing its normal caterpillar things. It has become a bodyguard for the wasp.
Several questions come to mind in listening to you talk about this. I guess first off is, does this tell us anything, as fascinating as it is in terms of caterpillars and wasps or the various insects that are being parasitized, is there any parallels that you can draw to possible human attack by parasites or human neuro disorders?
Well, I guess what we had hoped when we started, for many of us, when we started studying these, is that, of course, as you know, we don't know how brains work in general, anybody's brain, even little
right.
brains. And one of the things I was hoping is that the parasites could teach us something. Because what I've discovered, and my colleagues have discovered over time, is that parasites use very different methods than a neurobiologist would use to control behavior. So usually if you're a neurobiologist, you look for the part of the brain that controls that behavior, or you look for the chemicals that are important to control that behavior, what we call the neurotransmitters. And so you use these very targeted, very selective approach. And it turns out parasites do not do that, which was a big surprise, because we couldn't figure out how else would you do this. They have this very they have these series of non-selective mechanisms where they seem to manipulate a number of pathways just a little bit, as opposed to hitting with a sledgehammer one pathway. And the reason I think that this might, in the future, give us, but might be important to us, is that one of the challenges pharmaceutical companies have been facing, for example, is trying to design drugs to assist people who have mental disorders, for example. And they haven't been very successful, but they've been trying to do it the way a neurobiologist would do. So they've been trying, if you're suffering from depression, they've been hitting a pathway called, using a chemical called serotonin. So if you heard of Prozac,
right.
Prozac alters the way that pathway works. So they usually use one drug and you hit one system with a sledgehammer. But that's not how parasites work. And if we could figure out some of the ways they have, it might give us other routes, other things to try to alter the way we can try to repair brains, for example.
Wow, that's fascinating. Shelley Adamo is an insect behavioral physiologist from Dalhousie University, a professor in the university's Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. And the research on parasites appears, for those people who want to read, the Journal of Experimental Biology's current issue. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is KUOW Seattle. As the holidays approach, many of us start brainstorming ideas for homemade gifts, funny gifts, clever gifts, maybe gifts that tend towards sentimental The holidays are also a time when we personify things. The battery-operated Santa who moves about your house, the gingerbread man winces in pain when you bite off his leg, the wire deer outside is actually Rudolph grazing in the yard. The holidays are a time for magic and a time for family, and Katie Sewell weaves these ideas together with this story.
Like many things in life, this story is starting with a simple choice. Pick a hand. Any hand. Go on, pick one. Okay, I don't actually have anything, but my sister was helping run this garage sale last summer. I love garage sales. So I asked Sarah to look through the piles and pick me out something good. I was thinking like a rug or a lamp. She had other ideas. Out of the piles, Sarah picked up two stuffed toys. A duck and a cow. Then she sent a picture text to my phone. It was a picture of her sitting in the grass, both hands behind her back, and the caption read, "Pick a hand." So I picked the right one. Turns out, I picked the cow. The Henrietta saga began. My sister, Sarah.
Henrietta is a stuffed blue cow. She's got little spots on her, but they're not just any spots. They're cloud spots. They look like little clouds. She has a slightly crooked nose and some tiny little yellow horns. Henrietta's very squeezable, you know? She gives comfort when you squeeze.
My text message back to Sarah? I don't want it.
That's true. You crushed her feelings.
Her feelings or yours?
Hers. She started crying right then and there. So I decided to take her home. And thought, if you're going to turn her down, I'm going to bring her to you.
She dragged this cow all the way across the country to the annual family vacation in South Carolina. And when I arrived, this cow, the one I had entirely forgotten about, was sitting on my bed.
Kept sitting her in your bed at night, ready to be tucked in to go to sleep with you. And you kept sitting her on the shelf like you didn't really care.
We should mention that we're both in our 30s at this point.
We are, but... you know, we were going back to something from our childhood. We were sharing twin beds in a room, and it takes us back to when we were 7 and 4.
Sarah and I shared a room when we were kids, and we also shared this ability to make anything have a personality. Here's a great example. Balloons. We used to always draw faces on balloons. New face, new personality, new possible death from popping. Mm-hmm. So we actually had a plastic container called the Balloon Hospital for every single one that popped.
Balloon Hospital. Forgotten about that.
Yeah. We personified popped balloons. So she's right. I probably did appreciate the gesture more than anyone.
That's right.
But still, I hadn't changed my position. I didn't want a stuffed cloud cow in my life, even one that did have a name.
You put her in my suitcase.
So when Sarah wasn't looking, I stuffed her back into Sarah's suitcase, and it went safely back to Montana.
I noticed that you put her in there, but I thought, if you don't want her, then I'll take her back to Montana.
And I forgot about it again. Entirely. That is, until the holidays happened 6 months later. Sarah was especially gleeful about her gift to me, so I was very anxious to open it. And when I tore the wrapping paper off, it was a red photo album full of pictures. Pictures of, yes, you guessed it, Henrietta.
She was cute. And she'd kind of taken on her own little personality.
The book opened with a note.
Katie, I know you were secretly very sad that you accidentally left me behind in Hilton Head Island. I'm sure you've spent days and stayed up nights thinking of me, or perhaps pining for me, and wondering how I fared in Montana. I thought you might appreciate a little snapshot of my life and my adventures since we parted.
The project was simple at first. Sarah just took some pictures of Henrietta doing simple chores around the house.
Watching TV, eating cereal. Reading a book.
She intended to just send me a couple shots as a joke and say, "Hey, see, look, Henrietta's adjusting just fine to life without you in Montana. You rejected her, so what? She's fine." Then the cow hit the road. A day trip to Yellowstone.
Hadn't been to the park in a while, and we thought, we'll just kind of pile in the car. And I'm like, I should take the camera. And I'm like, I should take Henrietta. Why not?
Pictures of Henrietta with buffalo.
Old Faithful and Petrified Rock.
Sitting on the 45th parallel.
Pretty waterfalls.
Oh, and it didn't stop there. Later in the summer, she's hiking in Glacier National Park.
Climb trees, laid by the lake.
She's driving a backhoe.
Learned to rock climb.
She's riding high in a hot air balloon.
That was close quarters in the hot air balloon basket, and I'm pretty sure the couple who was with us that we didn't know was in the process of getting engaged on the flight, and here we're hanging off the other side with Henrietta outside the balloon.
Impressive, yes, but this hardly compared to the next section of the album, a cruise. This cow suddenly had been all over the Mediterranean.
Monaco, Italy, Greece, Turkey, England.
I haven't even been on a cruise. Have you? This cow went on a cruise. And if that's not enough, when she got home, she immediately flew to Los Angeles.
Shop on Rodeo Drive and go up to the Hollywood sign. And
for a Madonna concert.
See Madonna in concert? I mean,
have you seen Madonna?
Every cloud cow's dream.
All this travel took place in 6 months. So you can see how this book is unfolding.
The kicker was trying to decide whether to just give the album or to actually give Henrietta along with the album. And so there was a lot of debate about whether or not to part with her. And that's kind of when you knew, perhaps I have a little too strong of an attachment to this cloud cow. So because it felt a little weird to be so attached, we put her in the gift. My mother was very good at making things come alive. It was kind of a way to teach empathy, I think. Be careful, don't just kick that rock. You shouldn't kick that rock. You're going to hurt the rock's feelings, you know, or it might hurt the rock, which is a ridiculous premise, but probably affected getting you not to kick the rock, I suppose. And then it kind of got a little snowballed into every little thing, from stuffed animals to rocks to twigs to feathers. You know, I thought it was funny when I gave Henrietta to you as a gift, then I come over to visit her, and the only picture she's taken so far are pictures of her butt on the copy machine. Quite frankly, I thought that was a little rude. She's an innocent cloud cow, after all. She doesn't need to be taught those things.
Okay, so I wasn't the most creative nor tactful guardian of this little stuffed cow, but did you notice that my sister said, when I came to visit her? When I came to visit her, she traveled to Seattle to see the cow. Not me, Henrietta. Every phone call, she started asking for updates. What is she doing? Is she getting into trouble? Truth was, Henrietta was sitting on a shelf in my closet, so when I went to visit Montana in June, Henrietta returned home.
Henrietta, you did come! Oh, so nice to see you! Oh, very nice. You're going to make me get all teary. It's nice to see you again. It's funny, I'd put her in
the... You are teary!
I know!
Why does it make you teary to see her again, Sarah?
Well, she's come such a long way. Lots of good memories.
Now, if you're thinking to yourself, why would anyone do something like this and get attached in the meantime? I think my sister did it for me. Actually, it's probably more fair to say that she did it for us.
Maybe this is where my sentimental side comes out.
With a stuffed cow.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you can't say it to people, say it to the cow.
She did something remarkable, really. She reclaimed a period of time when we both found it easy to laugh and we didn't necessarily think everything was as it seemed to be. Our childhood. A place where rocks laze around with no fear. Balloons have their own medical care. And any object is worthy of its own adventure. This is Katie Sewell, the aunt of a personified stuffed cow, for Wheat Day.
This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Good morning, it's 9:32. I'm Andy Hurst. Deciphering someone's genome once took considerable time and resources, but the process has become so efficient in recent years and so much less expensive, it's even stirred talk of everyone getting decoded at birth. Later today, we'll explore the pros and cons of decoding our DNA so early in life. That comes your way this afternoon at 2:30.
Support for KUOW comes from At a Glance Wallmates, a new line of self-adhesive dry erase planning products for the home and office. More information at ataglance.com.
This week in This American Life, a Pentecostal bishop gets a revelation that everybody's going to heaven, whether they believe or not. Nobody's going to hell.
We've been sold a bill of goods. The God we've been preaching is a monster. He's worse than Saddam. He's worse than Osama bin Laden. He's worse than Hitler. Because Hitler just burnt 6 million Jews, you know, but God's going to burn at least 6 billion people.
What it's like to be a modern-day heretic this week.
This American Life, tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock.
KUOW and Fry Art Museum present Moment Magnitude, a cross-platform project featuring 24 Seattle-based artists from a wide range of media. Moment Magnitude reopens in a new configuration at the Fry on December 8th and will be on view through January 20th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Clouds and rain, 42 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting rain this morning, tapering off to just a chance of rain later today. Temperatures in the low 40s. It's going to be cloudy tonight, the low in the upper 30s. Cloudy, rainy, and breezy tomorrow, the high in the low 40s.
I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scher. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie started writing at the age of 7. She says she wrote stories about the characters who populated the books that she was reading, characters with blonde hair and blue eyes, characters who ate apples and cheered the appearance of the sunshine. She was writing these stories in her native Nigeria, where she also says the sun shone a whole lot and they didn't eat a lot of apples. They ate other kinds of fruits. Adichie is an award-winning author now. Her stories are based on her own experiences growing up in Nigeria, coming to the United States, and now I guess you're binational. Is that fair to call you? I'm not quite. You're still a Nigerian national.
I am Nigerian. I'm a Nigerian who spends a bit of time in America.
Your debut novel, Purple Hibiscus, was about the impact of politics and religion on a Nigerian family. Your latest book, The Thing Around Your Neck, is a collection of short stories, and it's about Nigerians at home and abroad. So that lens, looking at the blonde-haired, blue eyes, you left a long time ago.
Yes, I am happy to announce that I no longer write about what I don't know. And I think, really, it was just about that I realize in retrospect how influenced you are by what you read, especially when you're a child.
You grew up as a reader, so I was like an avid reader, right?
Yes.
What about any book that you picked up, yours or these ones that you were, you know, what grabbed you and what continues to fascinate you as a reader and a writer?
I like a good story. I think when I was, it's interesting though, when I was younger, I could just fall completely into a book and be absorbed for hours. And I can't do that anymore, I miss that. I can no longer read as the child I used to be.
Do you think it's that children, they're like friends, those characters in the books, and you're part of their life?
I suppose so, but I think maybe it's also that now that I've become a writer, in some ways I know the tricks.
Oh.
So I'm reading, I'm thinking, I don't really like that paragraph, and wait, I don't really believe that character. And so it's so hard for me to, I suppose what it is now it's difficult to completely suspend my disbelief. And I miss that. But I still love to read. And now I also quite appreciate language in a way that I didn't when I was younger. So I'm quite happy to read a story where nothing really happens, but the language is beautiful. But in the end, I just like a story. I like character.
So I heard that you started reading at a very early age, before most children do learn to read. What compelled you to actually, I'm assuming it was a pen and not a computer, what compelled you to actually, what compelled you to make your own stories?
I don't know. I think, you know, that I really don't know. I did. You know, and looking back now, I suppose I'm having to invent an answer to a question like that. Mm. Because when I was doing that, I wasn't conscious. I didn't sort of wake up and something happened, and then I thought, okay, now I'm going to write. I just wrote because I was drawn to stories, because I was the child who watched people and the child who dreamed and the child who was sort of not quite entirely present in the present.
You're in those books. And you're reading a wide range of English literature. You grew up in Nigeria. At what point did you discover African literature?
I think it was about maybe 9 or 10.
So pretty early.
Yeah, well, late for me, because I started to read, I was 3 and I was reading, and when I was 7, I was reading things I had no business reading, really, when I think about
like
it.
Like what?
You don't want to know. I discovered, actually it was Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart and Kamaralaye's The Dark Child. And those books, now that I look back, changed my life because I realized I can write about who I am and what I am.
What was your reaction reading that first book that was about your own well, not your personal experience, but an experience more similar to your own than The Secret Garden might have been.
Yeah. Oh, and I love The Secret Garden.
So did I, but probably not quite. I mean, it wasn't like my experience either.
No, it wasn't. And do you know, I suppose it was, and it was Things Fall Apart. It was familiar, but also quite exotic, which is interesting because it was set 100 years ago. Mm. And so it was about my people, but it was about my people 100 years ago. So I, for example, was horrified about what they ate for breakfast. I thought, oh, my Lord. Right? And also that they lived in huts. I thought, good Lord. And, and I would imagine that maybe bugs would crawl into like that sort of thing. But also there was just a sense of, there was an affirming feeling about it, I think. And now that I think about it, I like to call it a glorious shock of discovery.
A glorious shock of discovery. That's wonderful. Do you write that down? As a word lover. We're talking with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and she's going to be speaking this evening as part of Seattle Arts and Lectures at Ben Arroyo Hall, and that talk is at 7:30 this evening. That idea of writing about history, you did write about one war that I suppose wasn't 100 years ago, but you have looked back, but your current collection of short stories is very contemporary. It's about the now. It's a, and it got me to wondering how much of when a writer addresses the now, whether it's about immigrant Nigerians or there's a great story about a brother and sister, and the brother's kind of a criminal. That's the wrong word, but he's not an upstanding citizen, as upstanding as his sister would like him to be. But you're addressing contemporary concerns, so you know I'm always led to wonder how much comes out of personal experience, personal observation, and how much does a writer of fiction just make up, and where do those points intersect?
Oh, I don't know that. I don't think there's a formula. I think it's all of those things, and I think it also depends on the story. So, some of my stories, the story you refer to, where the brother is slightly alternative, nicely, is very loosely based on my brother, who doesn't like that story at all.
I bet not.
But my brother is just this wonderful, handsome, charming rogue, and. But then other stories just come from, you know, I listen to something. I'm a very keen eavesdropper. I just love to sit and listen to other people.
Do you carry a notebook with you?
I do. And now I have this iPhone app where I write things in. And sometimes when I don't have the time to write, I dictate into the phone and it's fantastic.
So pieces of dialogue?
Yes. And it's incredible. And often what I love about eavesdropping is because it's so out of context, you hear something, you don't know what's before and after, it gives you room to invent. Mm. And in much the same way that I like to look into people's homes. So if I'm walking on the street and a window...
I do that too.
And a blind is not drawn. I love to look in and then I imagine what the lives are like.
So when you talk to your fellow writers, is this something that you all share?
I think so. I mean, sometimes when we're in a gathering, gathering of friends who also write, and somebody will say something and then we all sort of say, can I use that? And we're sort of, you know, bringing out our notebooks and our phones to write it down. But I do know that some writers claim that they just imagine, which I just quarrel with, because I think imagination comes from somewhere. It doesn't fall from the sky. And, you know, my imagination is very active, but it starts from something, you know. And I suppose because I write realist fiction, so I'm not sort of doing fantasy.
No, it's not fantasy, although for readers who've never been to Nigeria, a lot of it seems fantastical, mm-hmm. particularly because your country was embroiled and is still embroiled in conflict. But had a civil war. I think you were living there. I'm not sure if you were in the United States while going.
No, I wasn't even born.
You weren't even born. So it was before you. So,
yeah.
But there's aftermath, and the neighbors of Nigeria are undergoing lots of conflict as well. It's not an ending thing.
It's not. But I don't think about Nigeria as embroidered in conflict. I think about Nigeria as a place that has difficulties, obviously, and the most recent one being politicized Islam in northern Nigeria. But, you know, it's home. It's where I'm very interested in sort of the ordinary stories. People are falling in love and people are getting married and getting divorced and people are fighting with each other about minor ridiculous things. And, you know, people are looking for jobs. And I'm very interested in that. Also very interested in gender and what it means to be female in contemporary Nigeria and all of those things. So,
well, what does it mean to be female in contemporary?
Oh, it means many things.
I mean, what we hear in this country from countries across Africa, there's these examples of incredibly strong women. Wangari Maathai is one. Women who step forward, have a lot to say, whether they're writers, they're political activists, environmental activists. I'm sure that there are men, but I'm female, so I'm noticing the women as well. But I wonder, are they condemned? Are these women, do they have a harder time speaking out? Or is it just that it happens across the world and perhaps in some countries the discrimination or the pushback is less subtle than in other places?
Yes, I think that's what it is. I think that being female is many things all over the world, but also the incredible similarities. And I call myself a happy feminist. And I'm very interested in gender all over the world. But of course, Nigeria, because that's where I'm from and that's where I love. But I just sometimes it seems to me that sort of Western, and by Western, I mean, you know, the US and Western Europe, that the feminism there there's a sense in which women still define themselves by men, if that makes sense, in a way that really doesn't exist in Nigeria, I don't think.
Really?
No. No, not in a society in Nigeria expects women to get married, right? You should. So one of our most respected ministers is a woman. Banks are led by women. But people will say to you, well, what about getting married? Right? You've really achieved very much, but what about your husband? But what I find in talking to women is it's not so much that they think they need men, it's that they sort of buy into society wanting them to need men. I think that's different in the West. I think in the West, women really do feel, to a large extent, that they need men. I mean, I think men are fantastic, right? I'm married to a very wonderful man. But I think just the idea for me, it's very interesting, that idea of you're incomplete without a man. And so I find a lot of women in Nigeria saying, well, I have to get married because they want me to get married. And then they'll say, oh, I just want to have children. Right. So, which I find quite interesting. But in general, I think my husband and I got into a taxi a few days ago in Boston. And the taxi driver turned to him and said, where are you going, sir? And he made me think about this idea of being invisible. It happens in restaurants. It happens, you know, they talk to the man. And it happens in Nigeria. So you go to a restaurant with a man and you're just ignored.
Huh. So that's the global aspect of being a woman. How old were you when you first came to the United States? Was it college age?
Yes, I came I had started university in Nigeria and I was supposed to be a doctor. After 2 years in medical school, I decided to flee. And I came to America because I didn't want to be a doctor.
Did you know you wanted to be a writer?
I was writing. I thought I was a writer when I was seven. I felt I had to do something to earn a living. So I thought I would become a doctor, become a psychiatrist, use my patient stories for my fiction. But then I realized I just couldn't survive medical school. I was so bored.
There'd be many people jumping to take your place, I'm sure, at medical school, at least in this country. You gave a TED Talk where you talked about your roommate in the United States and I was fascinated by the ignorance she had about Nigeria specifically, Africa in general. You were shocked too.
So I was more than shocked. And I suppose it was because I had come from Nigeria where, as you know, American pop culture is just everywhere. And so America, I didn't know America, but in some ways it was familiar, you know, because America really isn't what you see in the movies, but still it makes it a bit familiar. And then to come to the U.S. and to have people say, you know, do you listen to tribal music? I just thought, really? Do you really have no idea that the rest of the world?
Tell our listeners what you answered when she asked what you listen to.
You know, she said, well, you listen to tribal music? And I said, well, yeah. And then I gave her my Mariah Carey tape.
That's the tribe that you're listening to. And she also was surprised that you spoke English.
Yes. Yes, which I also found very, because I just thought, wait, didn't you do sort of basic history in high school? By which I mean, then at least you would know that there was colonialism in Africa and that, but But no, people would say, oh my God, you really speak English well. And I would think, well, yeah, because Nigeria is English speaking.
Do you feel pressure as an artist or writer of fiction to educate as
no,
well?
No.
And then sort of part of that question is also the role that increasing availability of literature by African writers, by Asian writers, by South Asian writers. What do you think that the availability of that of those stories does for our awareness of other cultures, other countries?
I don't know because I don't know that I can answer. I mean, I'm on the side of the African writing. I don't know about the non-African reading.
So let's just right? talk. Yeah, let's just talk about the African writing.
So I really don't. A friend of mine who has a wonderfully sarcastic sense of humor said recently that Africa doesn't have an image problem. The rest of the world has an ignorance problem. And because I love sarcastic humor. But really, I write stories. And my hope is that whoever likes the kind of stories that I like will connect to my stories. I don't set out to somehow, somehow set the world right about where I come from.
I'm sorry. But the availability of or the increasing availability of literature stories that are universal stories set in other countries, in other cultures, has to have some kind of subtle effect on our perceptions of those places.
Well, I would hope so. I think the internet as well has made quite a huge difference. It's been almost 15 years and I think a lot has changed. And my hope is that if another version of me came to the US mm-hmm. today, that the roommate would not say, you know, do you listen to tribal music? Because I think the perception would be that maybe you've been on Facebook and you see that there are Nigerians on Facebook. So maybe if they have computers, they also have access to different kinds of music. And that's.
Well, when you talk about music, not literature, there's an increasing availability of African pop music, mm-hmm. Both directly from Africa, but also coming through Paris, coming through London, coming through European capitals, because those were the colonial rulers of so many African countries. There's also an increasing availability is a strong word, but you see more African movies, at least in Seattle, African-made films about Africans, not in English, you know, subtitled films made in a country. And it seems when you talk about the U.S. Global culture that as these other artistic forms or information forms become available, that we become a smaller place.
I suppose yes and no. We become smaller, but I mean, you know that whole thing about globalization making us one village? Not really. And I think it makes us many villages where we sort of, you know, peek across at the other village, but sort of still remain in our village. I do think it's a very good thing. I do think that it's important to watch different kinds of films, to listen to different kinds of music. And, growing up, I remember just watching all of these American films and some British and Nigerian ones. And, you know, I think it's a good thing. But I think also that... you know that category of music called world music? I think what I would love to see is where that is banished. A Nigerian musician who's very sort of pop would be in world music, when really that Nigerian musician should be with other pop musicians.
Pop music.
Yeah.
That may happen. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's newest book, which is a collection of short stories, is called The Thing Around Your Neck. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And now,
this is the sound,
the sound
of the week.
Know what that is? Weekday listener Christine sends us this sound from her iPhone. She says, I'm sitting in my car with my hyper neurotic dog. The dog's convinced even after 10 and a half years of always coming back to him, somehow he's going to be abandoned. That breaks my heart. I wonder if he's drooling too. hyperneurotic dog. What interesting songs are you listening to? Record 30 seconds and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. You email that sound to weekday at kuow.org with sound of the day, not the week, but sound of the day in the subject line. And thanks to Christine for that. Well, the sound of my morning was raindrops. It's Friday, and it's time to find out if we can expect anything other than gray skies and more raindrops. And Nick Bond, Washington State climatologist, joins us. Hi, Nick.
Hey, good morning.
Is that what I'm going to hear, sound of the weekend? Rain, rain, rain?
Well, today, not so bad. We're kind of between systems here, and there's a few sprinkles around, and we've got kind of a wimpy convergence zone. But today is not so bad. On the other hand, there is another system coming in tomorrow, and so expect a rain to develop around midday and be kind of breezy and continued on the chilly side during the day, and then turning to showers Saturday night, and another system coming in Sunday, again with steady rain developing late in the day. And what really have an eye on there is the potential for some pretty strong winds with that one.
A windstorm. We're expecting a big windstorm, huh?
Well, there's the potential. It's not taking the perfect track for very strong winds in the central Puget Sound area, but it is definitely has the potential for scattered power outages and that sort of thing. I wouldn't be surprised. Sustained winds of around 30 miles an hour,
wow,
and gusts into the 40s.
Well, that's pretty strong winds.
Yeah, yeah. It's not going to be one of those storms that gets a name like the Hanukkah Eve storm or the Inauguration Day storm, but still, you might want to tie down your dog.
Wow. And is that a typical kind of thing that we would see in December?
Well, we get them, of course, from time to time. And I poked around in some of the statistics about that, and it turns out that different spots, of course, get winds more often than other places. And so for the least windy spots like Boeing Field and Olympia, they get a storm with winds up into the 40, 50 miles an hour, just, each December or even some Decembers none. But in the North Sound, it's much more frequently, two or three times a month it happens there.
And is that more common November, December, January, February than it would be, say, June, July, August?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And the one spot that can be windy here in the summer is North Whidbey Island, a Naval Air Station there in Oak Harbor. It's subject to the west winds that blow down the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And so that's a windy spot kind of all throughout the year. But for the most part, of course, our windstorms are here are a winter thing.
Now, my son has been praying for snow down here in the lowlands. All these rain showers and rain, steady rain that you're predicting, we can expect snow in the Cascades. Are you looking ahead to any kind of snowfall down here?
Not in the foreseeable future.
White Christmas?
I'm wishing as hard as he is, but I just don't see that yet. I'm not saying it can't happen, but certainly there's nothing kind of on the horizon. Now, we're in a cool enough weather pattern that even tomorrow morning there could be a few kind of mixed snow, rain showers and so forth, but certainly no accumulations. And so we're going to, kind of flirt with some of that. But so far, no cold air outbreaks in sight.
Are we at sort of average temperature for this time of year? Warmer, cooler?
November was a little warmer than normal.
Okay.
But recently we've been running pretty near normal, and especially our days with the temperatures in the just low 40s, mid 40s maybe. That's about par for the course, or a little on the cool side. Our nights haven't been that cold just because it's been cloudy, and we need really a clear night for it to get frosty in that. So where it's kind of par for the course.
So to reiterate, we're in between storm systems at the moment,
right.
And we can expect a sort of increasing steady rain over the weekend, and then the wind should arrive Sunday.
Yeah, and this wind, it would be of Sunday night or probably early Monday.
Okay.
And then it's something that I'm going to be keeping an eye on, because it's our computer models that we rely on so much, they're a little bit inconsistent about exactly where this storm is going to go and its timing. But still, the potential there is there, and not just for winds, but for maybe some coastal flooding, in that the low pressure can mean that higher sea levels, and there's big waves coming in. There happen to be some high tides, and so some of the places that are prone to coastal flooding might have some minor problems.
Well, Nick, we'll look forward to you keeping an eye on it, and we'll keep our eye on you. Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He's a regular Friday guest on the show. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, of course, in the next hour, it is Friday, so our panel of journalists will be here. Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, and Joni Balter will be in to talk about everything from same-sex marriage to two state Senate Democrats aligning themselves with the Republicans. Our show always available at our website. That's kuow.org/weekday. And remember, if you haven't yet friended us on Facebook, still looking for that 4,000 mark. It's Facebook's weekday at KUOW. So check us out there. This is 94.9 KUOW.
Good morning. It's a minute before 10. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away.
Support for KUOW comes from TIAA CREF, helping people pursue their financial goals. Learn more at TIAACREF.com.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.